Hello and welcome to Sunday Messages with Fairmount Friends Church. We're so glad that you are joining us. You can find out more on www.fairmountfriendschurch.org. This time, in part one of Race and Policing America, Pastor Brock Meyer facilitates a conversation with Latrice Moffitt, President and CEO of Voice LLC, and Alex Husky, Chancellor of Ivy Tech Community College of the Marion Campus, about their experiences and perspectives on race and policing America today.
Night to Fairmount Friends Church. It is a special night, no doubt, for the discussion that we're going to be having. But we just want to say thank you for coming and being a part of this evening. This is what we call our dinner and discussion. We do this once a quarter throughout the year, and we address a hot topic of what is going on in America, in our culture. And tonight is the topic of what is going on in today. And so just grateful for y'all to be a part of it. We also want to say hey to everybody that's joining us Facebook Live. Thank you for jumping on board with us. You're going to be able to see me sitting here at the table, as well as our people that we're going to be interviewing behind me. They're going to be on the screen joining us. A couple of people we're going to have tonight is Latrice Moffitt. I got connected with Latrice. Alyssa and I have actually done work with her through TLC Management. She has done some of the diversity training, as well as helping our staff work through any of our relationships with different races. And also Alex Husky, who is the Chancellor of Ivy Tech College, the Marion Campus. And he's going to be a part of it. And Latrice and Alex, if you are there, go ahead and sign on to the camera, to our video call here. Hello, guys. Good to have you here. Such a joy to see you joining us. And so it's going to be a great opportunity and conversation. Alex, who was going to be here with us tonight, just had an emergency eye surgery this week, and he's unable to actually be here present, but he's generous enough to join us on a conference call, and so grateful for them to be a part. As we dive in here, I'm going to kind of have all of my homework here in front of me, and so I'm going to be seated, as well as Alex and Latrice, as they've got theirs in front of them as well. And my connection to Alex came through a relationship with Brett Carey, and Brett was here earlier. Appreciate Brett, who serves on the board with Alex and with Ivy Tech. And as I sat down with Alex, I said, I got connected to you through Brett Carey. And he said, I like that guy. There's something about that Brett Carey that I like. And called him a young man who had like this goodness inside of him. And he said, I didn't realize that he was connected to your church. And I said, yes, he's connected to our church. His family has been, you know, in our church for years and years, that there's just this Jesus connection through it all. So this is the conversation, right? And I feel that this is the conversation that is so needed. And as I now turn to Alex and Latrice, probably many in our community, which is the Fairmount and Summitville area, we may have some from Jonesboro or Marion as well, but for the most part, in this maybe Madison Grant area, we would feel like there's not a ton of racial tension on our minds. And could I maybe say that that is part of the problem? It's not even on our minds. Maybe we should be a little bit more mindful of it, that we would even be aware of what is going on. And so as we ask these questions, I just want to say, first of all, perhaps not everything is going to be said correctly or maybe correct terms. I'm going to do my best, but hopefully we can have a ton of grace for one another. And I truly believe that we are coming into tonight to learn, that our hearts and our minds are wide open, and we need taught. We need to learn a little bit from what we have perhaps previously always known. I want to start off with this scripture And this comes out of James chapter 1, and starting in verse 19. It says this, "My dear brothers, take note of this. Everyone should be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to become angry. For man's anger does not bring about the righteous life that God desires. Therefore, get rid of the moral filth and the evil that is so prevalent, and humbly accept the word planted in you, which can save your life." We're believing that we're going to have some words planted into us tonight. Hopefully that will be life-saving, life-giving. So let's be quick to listen tonight. Let's not be quick to speak. Let's not be quick to rebuttal. Let's be quick to listen to the stories of a couple other people that have had much different experiences than the majority of people sitting in this sanctuary tonight. We're inviting everybody to this conversation. The bulk of the conversation is going to be an interview between myself, Alex, and Latrice, and then we're going to field some questions from the audience at the end. So if you have a couple questions, please just hang tight to them, and we'll take a few of those at the end. I can tell you we've had this night kind of set out for Andrew a month, 6 weeks, I don't know, whenever kind of all started, we said, now's the time. And I've been giddy. I've been ready for this night. And so we're going to have some fun with it. If you've been at a dinner and discussion before, you kind of know the flow of it. But here's kind of a little bit of how the flow will happen. I'm going to play host for the evening. I'll interview Alex and Latrice, and then they will begin to answer some of our questions that I have prepared, and they'll field some questions that you may have. Latrice, we're going to start with you. Latrice is the president of Voice LLC. She travels the globe doing diversity training. And like I said earlier, Latrice and I got connected as she is beginning to do some diversity training with TLC Management. And she has, I believe, a specific revelation on this idea of unconscious bias. Alex Husky, who he's going to get into, share a little bit about his story, was a young man who his father had rolled out on him early. He was raised by a pretty awesome mama who locked it down at home, and his story is unique as he got into some gang activity, and then God radically got a hold of his heart. He went off to the military. He loves his country. He fought in the Air Force. He was a police officer. Whenever I sat down with Alex, I said, "Alex, do blue lives matter?" And he said, "You better believe it. I'm a cop. My uncle, my grandfather, police officers." I said, "Do black lives matter?" Absolutely. And he can speak on that one. And so he's got just such a unique perspective. And a guy who dropped out of college became the president of a university. How does that work? He is a special breed that he's going to bring to us tonight. So Latrice, I would like for you to jump in here. Just a little bit about your background. Who are you? Where did you come from? And how has God given you a perspective on these racial issues?
Well, I am originally from Clovis, California, which is a very small rural community in California. It's down in the valley. It's near Fresno, California. It's halfway between San Francisco and Los Angeles. I grew up there my whole life. My parents are both African American. I was adopted at 3 months old. I'm a biracial child. I was not told that I was adopted until I was 21, although I knew at about the age of 9. Just because of experiences and things that I overheard. The community that I was raised in was very affluent. It was all white. My family was the only family of color, except for the librarian at the elementary school. They were the only other black family in the entire community. To say that it was a racist community and not a safe environment would be an understatement. We had a lot of heartbreaking experiences there, but my parents never sold, never left, and used those opportunities to teach us how to be empowered in a world that may never give us the respect or the love that we craved. And I appreciate that. I just lost my father within the last 6 weeks during the coronavirus time, and I've not been able to get to California to do the memorial service yet. I lost my mother about 4 years ago. So both the parents that helped to rear me and pour into me and equip me for this work are no longer with me physically, but they are definitely in my heart. I had one foot in one world and one foot in the other every day. I grew up in a Black culture in my family, in my home, but then when I went to school or I went to church or I went to practice, I was in a completely different culture. And so I had to navigate what that looked like. I had to weave back and forth and code switch, which if you don't know what code switching is, it's you have to change your mindset and you have to change your language and you have to change the way that you communicate and the way that you behave around people when they are different than you are so that you don't offend or that you can assimilate so that you can be successful in whatever environment you're in. So there wasn't a term for it at the time, but I've had to code switch my whole life pretty much. You know, my husband and I and my two kids all reside in Marion, Indiana now. My daughter just finished her year was cut short because of the virus. So she's graduated from Purdue, and my son just finished his master's degree at Fresno Pacific University. Janae will be going into the doctoral program for occupational therapy at Indiana Wesleyan. And my husband is a special assistant to the president for community and corporate relations at Indiana Wesleyan. So we've lived here for over 20 years now. We thought we'd be here for a couple of years and then we'd find our way back to California, but that didn't happen.
You all sound like a bunch of underachievers is what it sounds like to me. I wish you'd do something with your life. Oh man, that is awesome. So we've got a major player speaking on this for sure tonight. Alex, give us a little bit of some background story on yourself.
Sure. Thank you for having me, first of all. And I would just say that for me, I grew up, I was born in Arkansas, but raised in Flint, Michigan, and lived there until 1983, until a time that I went into the United States Air Force. And, you know, my time growing up, I have a great appreciation for what Latrice was saying, because it's ironic, though, I was stationed not too far from where she grew up. And so I understand the community in which she lived. But, you know, my life was an interesting life, if you would. I had a very, very good mother, very loving mother. My parents, who were who remained good friends even after their divorce. But my father was absent from my life until I was about 20 years old. And we did not make amends or have a good relationship until actually the death of my grandmother. I stayed in contact with his family, but he and I didn't really have a really good relationship until I was about 20 years old. And throughout my life, I had a lot of challenges. And one of the challenges that I had was a lot of people don't understand when you start talking about being involved in gang activity, and they automatically look at movies on TV and they see a bunch of guys hanging out in a street corner. And, you know, they're trying to invite you into this group so that you can wear these colors and you do all of that. But it's really not. And I often use an analogy with people when I talk about how you get involved in this activity. It's almost, for those of you who like to golf, it's almost like your friend inviting you to your favorite golf course that you wish you could always play in. But he doesn't tell you all the rules about the golf course until you get there. And once you're there, you begin to play. On that course, you begin to enjoy it. Then they begin to tell you, okay, well, here are the rules, and here's what it's going to cost you to continue, and here's what it's going to cost you to yeah. do all these things. And I found my life spiraling out of control, but thank goodness there, as you said, Brock, there was an intervention for God.
Yeah.
I was in and out of college about three times before I finished college. I finished my associate's, bachelor's, and then my master's. But that was a challenge. It wasn't something that I understood, because being first generation college student and all of my family, when I first went to college, there was no one to tell me about all the hidden rules and understated rules. And so I struggled and didn't have the answers. And when I went to people, they looked at me as though I was stupid. So I thought I was stupid, and I wouldn't continue to go to those individuals who didn't care for me the way that I thought I needed to be cared for. So anyway, I ended up in the United States Air Force. Enjoyed my career in the Air Force. I spent a total of 10 years, 4 years active duty, 6 years reserve. In 1987, me and my wife, I met my wife in the Air Force, which was a blessing. And we moved to Marion, Indiana, where she was from. We were not going to go back to Flint, Michigan, where I was from. The city had turned into all kinds of bad at that time. And we've been here in Marion, Indiana since. I spent 24 years of law enforcement. 14 of those years were with Marion Police Department, and my last, and I was assistant chief with the Marion Police Department for a period of time. And then the governor of the state at that time recruited me to become the superintendent for the state excise police. I was there with the state excise police and alcohol tobacco commission for 10 years. Then after, when I decided I was going to retire, I landed with Ivy Tech. And those were interesting and difficult journeys at the same time, because there seemed like there was all this always this underlying expectation that I was going to fail miserably. Instead of I was going to be successful, there was an expectation that I was going to fail. And I remember the one time that a really, really good family friend, someone who I really admired and respected, they even said to me, "You know, you are an anomaly." And I said, "What do you mean by that?" And they said, "Well, we never expected you to succeed." And I thought, wow, how does that supposed to make me feel better about who I am and what God has allowed me to do in my life? Yeah. But then I found out they were only telling me what so many other people were thinking. And when I really kind of got hold of that, it really made me think, you know, thank you, Lord, for helping me to be the person I've become. But also, thank you for helping me to overcome every obstacle. So now that I look back on my life, every obstacle that I faced was a blessing from God to train me for the next step of my life. Yeah. So I'm thankful to be here tonight to share with you.
Wow, it's powerful. Latrice, you shared your background. Just trying to, where do I fit, right? I'm biracial, then I'm given up for adoption. Who wants me? I'm adopted by all black family, raised in predominantly an all-white neighborhood. Where do I fit? You know, in a white neighborhood, I'm black. But in a black neighborhood, I'm not black enough, right? You've kind of lived with, am I accepted by any of them? Where is my home and kind of acceptance? And you've shared some stories about your father as he's getting ready for work and he's heading out to his car. And I just think it's a powerful story, because perhaps in Fairmount, Indiana, we might not think that there's many racial issues. And yet you tell these stories that I'm like, oh my goodness, this stuff is still going on. So will you share that story about your father?
Sure. And I have to say that this is one of a plethora of so many stories, of so many experiences that we had. And I wish I could go into all of them, but we would never leave. We'd be here forever.
Yeah.
At this particular story, I said we lived in Clovis, California, and so I wasn't told that I was adopted. So as far as I was concerned, I was a black child. I was fair, and my mother explained that away by saying that her father was Creole, and they had French and Indian, and I must take after their side of the family. But then when we were five, we adopted my sister, and I knew we adopted her, and at the time, I figured if that's the way we got her, that's probably the way that we got me. And I was totally fine with that. But when I asked her about it, she denied it and said, no, you're mine. You're not adopted. And I was like, okay, but things just didn't make sense. And there were so many things that were happening. I didn't know why we chose to live where we lived, because it just seemed like people didn't want us there. This particular experience, I was between probably 6 and 8 years old. We would get up really early to have breakfast and to get ready for school in the morning. And I I must have been around 8 because I think I was either in first or second grade. And every time we would go out of town to visit our relatives in San Jose, our house was gutted. They would poison meat and throw it over the fence, and they killed my dog. When I came back as a child, I came back to a dead pet because they poisoned meat and threw it over the fence. Our house was gutted so many times, we just would just go out and buy furniture. This particular morning, my father got up, opened up the door, and he's looking at his car. He had a white Chevy truck, and it was always parked outside in front of the house. And he just kind of put his head down and he started shaking it. And I remember coming up behind him on his leg and I was like, "What's wrong, Daddy?" Because he was usually cheerful in the morning. And he goes, "Oh, baby, it's just a hard world." And I watched him go outside. And I followed him. I was a little girl. I was so much a daddy's little girl. I followed after him. And we got halfway to the car and he goes, "No, baby, go back. Go back in the house and wait for Daddy." And, you know, I kind of lingered there for a while. And I noticed that all the tires on the car were flat, on the truck were flat. And there was something written or smeared on the front of the windshield. And I kept saying, "What is that, Daddy? What happened? What happened?" And he was like, "Please just go back in the house. Please go back in the house." So I went back in the house, but I stayed in front of the screen door and I watched him. He went around and he checked every tire. It had been slashed. There was something white on the windshield and there was something smeared. And someone had taken a pair of underwear and defecated in them and taken the feces and written "Go home, nigger" on the front of the windshield of the car. And he, almost like a robot, took a stick, got the underwear off, flung it into the gutter, went and got the water hose, sprayed it off, and then went into the garage where he had like 8 tires that he would purchase and have in the garage, and got his jack out and he changed every tire, came in the house, took a shower, got dressed, kissed us on the forehead, and went to work. And I remember saying, who would do that? Like, why would somebody do that? And he didn't say a word. My father never swore. He never said a cross word. He didn't smoke. He didn't drink. He had a very tender spirit, but he had high blood pressure. And I do believe that he had to hold so much in. It just was toxic to his body to have nowhere to go and no way to get that kind of hurt and anger and frustration out. And this was a normal occurrence for us. I didn't tell Brock this, but my mother wouldn't let us go outside to play. We had to play inside or in our fenced backyard. And I had a new bike for Christmas and the weather was nice and I wanted to ride it. And she's like, I just want to ride it around the block. I promise I'll be right back. No, you can ride it in front of the house. And I'm like, you can't ride the bike in the driveway in front of the house. Like you can't do that. That's no fun. And I was just pleading and begging, can I just ride it around the block? Please, just one time, please. So she's like, fine. My nickname is BB. She's like, fine, BB, you can just ride it one time. And I'm going to stand out front and I'm going to wait till you come back around. And I was thinking, she's being ridiculous. And because I don't know. So I rode it around the block. And I made it back and I was like, see, everything's fine. Can I go one more time? And she goes, okay, you can go one more time. Where there were some boys in the house in the corner of our neighborhood in that circle. And they saw me ride around 2 times. My mom thought it was okay. So she went inside to get something. And the 3rd time around the block, they had taken a tube sock and they put rocks in it and they slung it around their head like a slingshot and they threw it in the spokes of my bike, knocked me off my bike, and they sicked their dog on me. And this dog was chasing me and barking at me and I'm terrified and I'm running home and my mom has a hedge of rose bushes on both sides of our house. And I literally jumped over the bushes and ran into the house and I was bitten by the dog. And, you know, my dad's getting a diaper and tying this up so that they can take me to the hospital. And, you know, I was like, I don't understand. And my mother was like ranting. She was cursing. She was like, see, this is why we shouldn't live here. This is why. And my dad, and she's like, she had a gun. And she's like, I'm going to go shoot him. And my dad was like, no, you're not. She's like, they almost killed. They like sicked a dog on our daughter. And my mom was the volatile one that was very aggressive. And my dad was the really calm one who would kind of calm her down. She had the gun in her hand and she was getting ready to go out of the house and down the block. And he pulled her back physically and held her while she was screaming and crying. And I was just traumatized and bleeding. And, you know, I finally got to the doctor and I got stitches and my dad were coming home and he goes, well, you know, I think God just wanted to show you that you're a really good athlete. You're real fast and you can jump real high. So you know what, maybe you'll do something with that one day, ironically enough. And he just had a way of de-escalating the situation to be able to kind of navigate through it so that you wouldn't hate and you wouldn't let that eat you up. And he said to me as I was going to bed that day, he said, baby, don't be mad at them. Don't hate them. He goes, pray for them. They just don't have enough Jesus in them. That's all.
Wow. Mm. Golly. Powerful story. And I appreciate you sharing some of the most painful stuff. And I hope that we're listening with our hearts wide open. And more than just taking in information, we're taking in the feel of all of this. Golly. Alex, is it okay for white people to speak on matters that they don't know anything about? The question is not, should white people know what black people have gone through? The question is it okay to speak on matters that we know nothing about?
I think that's a very, very broad question. And the reason why I say it's a broad question is because we have an ability and we have the freedoms to have conversations on matters. And we don't ever want to stifle anyone's ability to have a conversation. But we also must seek to understand. And I think sometimes we have conversations and we don't, and this is for everyone, we have conversations, but we don't seek to understand the other person's point of view. And if your conversation with me is simply to get me to, and I love the word Latrice used earlier, to assimilate. If your conversation is directed to get me simply to assimilate without trying to understand where I'm coming from or my point of view, I think there is a problem with that conversation. But I think if we're having conversations to really try to understand what's really happening, what is the core issue happening? And I often say a lot of times we speak from a lack of emotional intelligence. We don't understand, or social intelligence. And so we don't understand the perspective that the other person is dealing from. As I said earlier, when you think about me, I grew up in Flint, Michigan. Even though I'm African American, I didn't have all the same experiences as someone who grows up in Marion, Indiana. So for me to speak, be the spokesperson, quote unquote, for all, I can't do that. What I can speak from is a perspective and an understanding that I have. And that's what I hope others would do, is that they would speak from their perspective, but be willing to accept what others have to say as well.
Yeah, that's a great way to say it. I feel like we're such keyboard activists in America. We see something on TV, and the way that we're going to be activists is we hop online and we make a comment. And I'm just so over that, that I'm going to share my opinion through Facebook, or I'm going to send out a tweet, and somehow that's going to do something. Usually it just pokes the bear. It just stirs things. It's not really looking for solutions. And so tonight is a night where we want to have a conversation, right, to where we can listen. We're going to spend 99% of tonight listening to gain a perspective without us having to say something. I understand it's a broad question, But I just think that perhaps we're speaking on issues. And the Bible would say in Proverbs, a man who speaks on something he knows not of makes him a fool. So if you want to act like a fool, keep speaking on issues that you don't have a clue about. But if you do want to speak intelligibly, we ought to have conversations like this where we can peek in on the conversation. Miss Latrice, I would like for you to open up really kind of a couple layers of the revelation that you have on unconscious bias. The way that I've been raised is in a small town, you know, white neighborhood, white country, predominantly farming, agricultural area, you know, predominantly white high school kind of experience. And I'm thinking, I don't have any racial bias. And then you ask me some questions. Well, do you think this way? I'm like, yeah, probably. Well, what do you think about this? Yeah, probably. It's like, okay, well, unconsciously, you have this bias, not that you're intentional, you're unconscious about maybe just what's been put in you over the course of time. Could you maybe unpackage the term unconscious bias?
Yes, there's a lot of definitions for unconscious bias. I think for me, whenever I'm training, I try and use the simplest terms possible so people can kind of just wrap their head around it. But for me, unconscious bias is about examining our unconscious thoughts. And in order to examine our unconscious thoughts, we have to go back to our cultural software, what our belief system is, what our value system is, how we're raised. And there's different ways, there's characteristics of unconscious bias. And the first one is like a denial. No, I'm not biased toward anybody. I treat everybody the same way. And that in and of itself is proof that there's unconscious bias. We're all biased. We all have prejudices. We all have a lens that we wear that's given to us by our family and our family origin and our experiences that shape the way that we experience our world and ourselves. Your parents have given you a lens to look at the world and yourself. If you were raised in a dysfunctional family, let's say, or an example, and maybe you had a parent who was an alcoholic, or maybe they were just verbally abusive and they said something like, oh, you're stupid, you're never going to amount to anything, you know, you're an idiot. They just gave you a lens in which you see yourself. And so you grew up thinking, I'm stupid, I'm dumb, I'm never going to amount to anything. My confidence level is really low. And you've learned to see yourself through that lens. It's not true, but that's the lens that you've been given. And there's also a lens that you're given to look at the world and through experiences and to people and groups of people. And if you don't learn to take off that lens and ask to borrow somebody else's so that you can see life and people through a different perspective, we will never have an opportunity to do the work. Understanding unconscious bias is about being willing to do the work. It's recognizing that our values, well, I'll do this. First of all, it's an unconsciousness. Unconsciousness is just a lacking awareness of what you're doing that you're not aware that you're doing, or thinking things that you think are perfectly fine or true or right, when in all actuality, you have one angle of a situation and not the full picture. If I sit a bottle of water here and the label is in front of me, my perspective, my angle is I can see the bottle. I can't see the ingredients because I'm not on the other side of the bottle, but my perspective is that's a bottle and it's, you know, this is the kind of water it is. And maybe if you looked at the ingredients, maybe it's in a bottle of water, but what's on the back is that this is not water. This is some other substance, but I don't see that because I don't have that perspective because I'm not looking from that direction. I'm not looking from that angle. And so we have to really circumvent, we have to really look at a situation and people from every possible angle so that we can get the full understanding of who they are as a whole person, their life stories, their experiences. We have to be willing to listen and understand that we'll never understand. And I'll get to that later. The bias part of it is just a preference or inclination that inhibits impartiality. It's just thinking a certain way. And it usually involves I'm fair. I treat everybody the same. But research show that when you hold that kind of egalitarian value, that you still have this unconscious behavior that can be discriminatory. And impact does not equal intent. You can say, well, I mean, I said that and they got really upset and I didn't, that was not my intention. But we need to recognize that when we speak out of ignorance, referring to the verse that you just read, ignorance impact does not equal intent. So even though you didn't intend to hurt somebody, the impact was you did. Right. You did offend them. You offended them horribly. I'll give you a definition that says unconscious bias, which also can be explained as implicit bias, is an underlying attitude and stereotypes that people unconsciously attribute to a person or a group of people, and that affects the way that they understand and engage with that person or with that group of people. In order to unpack it, there's a ton I could tell you, but there's like 12 major areas that people tend to be, that are very evident in unconscious bias. And I don't know, Brock, how much time we have. So I can go through each one and just give like a real brief synapse of like what that means.
Yeah,
so
just
that people
hit the
can
highlights,
kind of get an
please.
Idea. Is that okay?
Yep. Hit the highlights.
Okay. So there's affinity. So unconscious bias is affinity bias, which is about connecting with others who share similar interests or experiences or backgrounds. Like, you know, people are like, oh, she's a real good culture fit. She has the same culture. Or I like hanging out with him or her because they like the same things that I do. So we're drawn to people who are like us.
Yeah.
And when we do that, when we're only open to being around people who like the things that we like and like to do the things that we do and think the way that we think, we have a culture fit, but we don't have a culture add. A culture add is when you invite somebody into your space that looks at things differently, that has a different experience, that believes differently, and you add their culture to the table, and it challenges you to look through a different lens so that you can see things through their perspective, which broadens your understanding of the world at large and hopefully allows you to connect with people outside of your norm so that you can be more effective in what you know. And when you are having conversations, there's a less likely chance that you're going to be offensive to people if you have had more conversations with people who are different than you are.
Yeah, so good.
There's confirmation bias, and that's when you draw conclusions about a situation or a person based on personal desires, beliefs, and prejudices rather than an unbiased man. So you said you were where you grew up, you know, this small town, there's a certain way of doing things. If you went to a big city, the culture would be very different. The way that you look at people of other colors and cultures is very different than somebody in New York or Chicago, a very urbanized area that's very diverse. And so there's that. There's attribution bias, which is kind of a phenomenon where people try to make sense or judge a person's behavior based on prior observations and interactions that they've had. You assume things about people without knowing the full story. I saw them do that, so they must be. I heard him say that, so he must think. I saw her wearing that, so she must be. You know, and it can just go on and on. But, you know, outside of your personal beliefs and your idiosyncrasies, you know, it's about peer pressure. And we think peer pressure is only with our kids. Peer pressure is alive and well in corporate America. It's in every church. It's in every family. When you think differently than what the majority in your circle thinks, there is pressure to keep your mouth shut, to make excuses. Well, that's just who they are. Well, you know, Uncle Bobby, that's just how he is. And he's always been that way. So it doesn't make any sense to challenge him on that.
We all got that crazy uncle.
I'm sorry, what?
We all got that crazy uncle.
When you let that go and you don't address those things, you're not a part of the solution, you become a part of the problem.
Yeah.
So there's the halo effect where because somebody has done something that's really great, you kind of put them on a pedestal. And then there's the horns effect where because they've done something negative, they've gotten in trouble, they've gotten to jail, then you know, they're unsavory and you don't want to be around them. You don't want your kids to be around them. You don't know the whole story. You don't know why they've done what they've done. You don't know what experiences they've had to put them in a situation where they've made those types of choices, and we write people off. There's a contrast effect where you compare two people and think that, well, if I hang out with this group, I'm gonna have these benefits. If I come against them, then I'm not going to have those same privileges. And once you have privilege, you don't want to give it up. You don't want to share power. People in majority, for the most part, don't like to share their power. They see it as giving up power instead of sharing it. And that's a very different thing. There's gender bias, where you favor one gender over the other. There's ageism, where people who are older don't tend to get the jobs that are available, or they're not seen as bringing anything worthy or valuable to the table. We don't take advantage of their experiences and their expertise and all that they did to bring us to where we are right now. There's a beauty bias, there's a height bias, there's so many that you can just kind of go into detail about, but the thing is that they are invisible influences. And the lens of bias distorts what's real. Talking about it causes people to get really defensive because they don't want to be told that they're prejudiced or feel that they're prejudiced or feel that they're biased. And so they get a little defensive and they want to make excuses or give reasons why this is that, or they want to say, well, that doesn't make any sense to me. So if I just ignore it and it'll go away. I don't like to hear that on the news. I don't like to be uncomfortable. People of color are uncomfortable every day. I have a friend who texted me, and I have a colleague, I have to make sure I say that right, who texted me and said, I want to understand what it's like to walk in a black person's shoes, what they feel like and what they go through. And I needed her, and I read the text, and I appreciated the text, I appreciated her heart, but I needed her to understand that she would never understand. I can't take my blackness off. I can't help you understand what it's like to be black when you're in the majority, in as much as you can't, as a woman who has children, explain to a man what it feels like to have a baby. They're never going to know, because they're never going to be a woman and they're never going to be pregnant. They're never going to feel that pain. They can come alongside you. They can support you. They can be an ally for you to get time off from work and get good pay. But they're never going to know what it feels like. And I need you to understand that when you are born as a person of color, we are born into a pandemic, just like we're having right now. We're born into a pandemic of racism, where our lives are in jeopardy every day, and we are crying out for people to change their behavior and to educate themselves and to do the right thing. And there are asymptomatic people walking around every day that they're not affected by it, but my goodness, they can affect our lives when they have that hate inside of them, and they have power and authority and privilege as well. And we may not be wearing physical masks, but we have to mask our emotions and our fears and our anger every day. We have to edit what we say, because if not, then we're that angry black woman or that angry black man with a chip on our shoulders. And people are, revelation brings revolution. And when people, all of this has been happening forever, for as long as we can remember. And we've known it and we've been saying it, but it's not until things are now being videotaped and seen that we are actually aware of it. And so people are tired of wearing their masks just like we are. Yeah. And they want a voice, and they're angry, and they're letting all that frustration out. They're not masking it anymore. And I don't agree with the violence, but I understand it. And if you can understand that, if you can wrap your head around the fact that we feel like, if you've been living in this pandemic and it's frustrating for you and you're tired and you are worn down and confused, and is the information you're getting even correct? And are people really dying, or are they just inflating the numbers? Are people, you know, that's how we feel every day. And I hope that that makes sense, for one thing. But these lenses that we're wearing through this unconscious bias that we're giving, we need those that are not in the minority to recognize that there may be some distortion there, that if I handed out a pair of colored glasses to everybody in the congregation, some were tinted pink and blue and green, it's not going to change what you see completely, but it will give a tint to it. You're not going to see the actual colors, the actual picture of what's in, it's going to be somewhat distorted. And that's what unconscious bias is. It distorts the reality. Not so much that there's not truth in it, but just that there's not enough truth in it. And our brains have to adjust to the slight distortion so that our perceptions of reality can become clear. As a Christian, I believe in a heart change, and there's little chance of impacting the mind and the behavior of people if you can't impact their heart. So in order for us to see clearly through these lenses, we need to see through the lens of Christ, not through the family that we grew up in, not through the people that we're trying to impress or the groups that we belong to, but the Word of God. That's got to be the ultimate.
Yeah. That's it.
It's got to be that, to take action and to retain that true knowledge and wisdom of God in order to understand new ways of seeing each other in this world that we live in and how broken people are, the world, and how to love each other and how to honor each other. And so it's really examining those unconscious thoughts and asking yourself, is that really God's truth? Is that really truth that I'm believing? Or do I need to do some work? Do I need to ask some questions? Do I need to come to something like this and just listen for a minute? And for that, and for everyone that's logged on, and for everyone that's sitting in the church right now, I thank you for that. From the very bottom of my heart, I thank you for that.
That's awesome. Well, we thank you for joining us, man. This is good for us. I'll tell you a couple of things that you said kind of pulled out for me. You're drawn to people like yourself, and we look more for the cultural fit than the cultural ad. Raised the way that I've been raised, and raising my children the way that I'm raising my children, I'm raising them with a limited lens, right? They've got a limited lens because I just haven't experienced all things. Raised right here in Fairmount, went to Madison Grant, went to Taylor University, pretty much, you know, first 19 years in Grant County, followed by the next 8 years in Grant County, have had a fairly limited lens. However, my time at Taylor University, got connected with a friend on Second West in Wingates. He was Second West in Center, and I was Second East. I was Second West. He was Second Center in Wingates Hall. Josiah Brown, and Josiah took me to his church in Muncie. And we go to a church in Muncie, and I'm the only white kid in this church. Let me tell you, that was an experience. An unconscious bias for me is I look at black people and think they're loud and they can dance a lot better than I can. And I would probably say a lot of people here would say, they're loud or they can dance. And would y'all just agree that you all can just dance better than we can, Latrice and Alex? Alex, you got some moves, bro, or what? No, he's shaking his head. No, he ain't got it.
I know some people, and that's not
the case. Man. Heard that. I got a broken bias is what I've got. But I go here, and it is Pentecostal, Holy Ghost. They're running up and down the aisles. I mean, the organ, the drums. I mean, I think you can have an entire worship set with an organ and drums. It was unbelievable. And so I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm the only one that doesn't fit. I got to kind of get involved. And so I'm running up and down, and I'm trying my best. I'm clapping off beat, and you know, I'm going through the aisles. And then after church, we all go to the pastor was bivocational, and he owned a fried chicken restaurant. And so we all head off, and we're now going to eat the fried chicken. And let me tell you something. I just felt my stomach growl already. The smell of that grease is still in my nostrils. It was unbelievable. We're just sitting around and talking, and I'm the only white kid now in the restaurant. And it feels different, right? It feels, I felt like for a moment, at least during that, on those Sunday mornings and Sunday afternoons, probably what you feel the majority of your life. You're the minority in the community, in the high school, in your job, in the restaurant, wherever, and just out of place. And it felt super out of place for me. No matter how much I tried to engage, I still was just different, right? I was raised very much different, and those biases were exposed on what I thought. And now all of a sudden, I'm seeing people that love Jesus, that have a passion for the Lord, that want to reach their community, that have a passion for Muncie, and they want to reach out and the ministry they're doing in the streets, and just on and on and on. That mindset was kind of exposed. A couple things. I want to go to you, Alex. There was a study done, and the applicant by the name of Jamal. Jamal needed 8 more years of experience than a kid by the name of Greg to be seen as equally qualified for the job. Another found that men from elite backgrounds were called back for interviews more than 12 times as often as identical candidates from non-elite backgrounds. Is there fairness in the hiring process today? What makes it fair? What makes it unfair whenever it comes to the hiring process, Mr. Alex?
Thank you for that question. I was always told never to answer a question with asking a question. But I have to ask the audience, and I can't see your faces. I can only see the backs of your head, unfortunately. but I would have to ask you, how many of you, when you hear the name Jamal, you have a perception that immediately comes to mind? And I pause there to ask that question because it's ironic that Jamal is a name that I used to use as an alias sometimes when I worked undercover, and I would watch how people would treat me with the name Jamal versus the name Alex. Trust me, the name Jamal evokes a different set of emotion than the name Alex. And the other thing I would say is that's very, very important. And Latrice made a good point when she talked about we often look for what is a good fit. And the other question I would ask for you today is, what is a good fit for you? What is a good fit for the organization? I'm a bivocational pastor. I pastor a church. I'm the chancellor for a college. And so when I started in my work to hire personnel, I was set on hiring people that represented the people that we were going to serve. And so what I did was I set the recruiting practices towards reaching out in the areas that we're going to serve. If we serve Latino populations, we should be represented by some of the Latino populations in our workforce. So how do I do that? I can't do that simply going in my personal network saying, hey, I need a good fit for this role, but we want to recruit people of diversity. And so what I had to do was I had to affiliate myself with Latino organizations. I had to affiliate myself with Middle Eastern organizations. I had to become involved with people and build. And I love what you, because I love that this is a Christian environment that we can have this conversation, because I believe that this is where relationship comes to play. When we can build relationships, then we can look at people differently, and we can look at their differences, but learn to appreciate their differences, even if his name is Jamal. And so I think that intrinsically that we do sometimes we give pause when we hear certain things that trigger some type of emotion in us, and whether we look at that or not as racism, I think it's a lack of emotional intelligence that creates a barrier that leads to a greater perception of racism. And I think a lot of that is so prevalent because if you look at many, there are many surveys and studies, and then you hear about the people that say, well, the reason why you were hired was because we needed more diversity. Wow, what a thing to hear when you're applying for a job. I'm hired because you need more diversity. How about you hire me because I am well qualified and I bring a diverse position or opinion to the workforce that will actually add value to the organization. And so when we start looking at the challenges that we face, I think sometimes the conversation gets caught up and we try to figure out the right things to say and they end up being the wrong things to say. I think sometimes when we look at how we make hiring practices or hiring decisions, I think that we use things like a good fit for the organization. I may not initially be a good fit, or I may not initially appear to be a good fit, but then what you might find is I may bring another added value to the organization that you have missed. And that's often what happens when people look beyond this. And this is where things like what Latrice spoke of earlier, code switching, becomes very, very important. Because I used to tell people before I heard the term code switching, I used to tell people I was bilingual. Now, the way that I'm speaking to you tonight is not a way that I were to go to Arkansas and visit with family, I would not speak to them in the same manner in which I speak to you tonight. They would tell me, boy, you forgot where you came from. You don't even know who you are anymore. and that's just a real conversation that we would have. And so when I visit with folks, I have to understand the dynamic of the culture that I'm visiting with. So even within our own race and ethnicity, there are subcultures in race and ethnicity. So to hire someone or not hire someone because of a perception, you don't know, you might be missing a good thing.
Your internet just jumped out real quick. Yeah, hang on just a second, Latrice. Alex, were you wrapped up? Because your internet sounded like it cut out just for a second.
I did cut out for a second, but I would just say that I have found that there have been times where people have come to me and said, what do I need to do differently? Please, you've been successful in life. What is it that I need to do differently? Because I've tried. I'm doing everything in my power. I just can't seem to catch a break.
Yeah.
And so when we talk about these things, we try to talk through processes and helping to have change the narrative of the conversation, sometimes even in an interview, so that people think twice about what they're saying and how they're making decisions.
Yep, love it. Latrice, real quick, we need to move on to the next one, but Latrice, did you want to say something?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, one, I appreciate everything that you said, Alex, and what he was describing was what is also some unconscious bias, which is name bias. And you're absolutely right, when you put your name on an application, people look at that and that's a black name. This is where they went to school. I don't know if they're the right fit, and you're absolutely right. And so, we're telling you what the issue is and people are like, okay, well, what do I do? How do I fix that? Well, if you are a person in authority and you are responsible for working with HR or you are in HR and you want to find the most qualified person and you don't want to be subjected to that unconscious bias that you don't even know that you have, take the names off the applications, take the personal history off, look at the qualifications that they bring to the table and give them a number. I know it sounds crazy, but give each application a number and have people look at what they bring to the table outside of race and ethnicity and what their name may or may not be like. Worked at Indiana Wesleyan for over 12 years and I was involved in hiring many people. And, I remember a conversation where there was an Indian name and like, oh, we're just going to put that application aside because this is an Indian person and they always have these harsh accents and I'm sick of students complaining that they can't understand their professor. I'd risk much rather. It's just easier if we hire somebody who speaks English really well. They never even met the man. I knew the man. The man spoke perfect English and had grown up in the United States his whole life and went to Harvard. Mm. So we make these assumptions about people. And it's exactly what Alex was saying. It's name bias. We talk about, and real quick, we talk about beauty bias. And, we're being really vulnerable here. We're kind of letting you be a fly on the wall to conversations that we have every day with our culture and our family. So beauty bias can be really simple. Like pretty people get, you know, more attention, or they get, you know, their salaries are higher, they get the better jobs because people, it's aesthetic. People like to be around them. So, but the beauty industry, up until recently, in the last couple of decades, Black people were not seen as images of beauty. It's just been recently that we were. And the ironic thing for us is we're perplexed because we were told that we weren't pretty because our skin was too dark and our lips were too big and our butts were too big and our hair was too kinky and curly. So then we watched the majority get lip implants, butt injections,
Yeah.
They tan at the tanning booth until they are in a place where they are, you know, exposing themselves to possibly getting cancer. They get perms to curl up their hair when it's straight. And we're just like, but those are the things that you said you didn't like about us. Those were the things that you said didn't make us pretty. But you want the characteristics of it, but you don't want the culture that comes along with it.
Poof.
You want to be tan. You want to have our hair. You want to have full lips. You want to have a nice figure. But you don't want to be Black because you know what comes along with that. Mm. So there's this constant conflict of tension that we live in, living within that tension of we're not good enough, but you know, you like our music, you want this, but you don't want us. You don't want to be around us. You don't want to do the work for us. And so
yeah.
I just wanted to kind of piggyback on that and just say, I agree, Alex, with everything that you said.
It's a good word, man. I'm quick to listen on that. That is good. Alex, let me come back to something that you said. Do you think when it comes to getting jobs or to hiring, we ought to have a priority of diversity, or should we hire the most qualified person? Are Black people looking for equal rights, or are they looking for special rights? Like, I want to be treated a little bit more special because I'm Black. I should be preferred so that you can have a more diverse culture. Or should they for real find the most qualified person?
You know, I would say this, and that's a very good question. I'm not looking for special rights. When I was hired in a position one time, and I was literally told this, you were hired because we needed more diversity. I was not looking for that because that wasn't a very good position to be in. First of all, you're in an environment where you already know that you may not be wanted. I mean, that kind of statement being made. And secondly, you're in an environment where people are waiting for you to mess up so that they can say, see, I told you that was the case. And in that position that I had, I'm just going to share this with you. I won't mention the name of the company because it's a well-known company. But in the position that I had, I was hired to do one job. But I remember the manager of the organization came to me one day and said, well, you know, we know what we hired you for, but and you normally get off work at 5 o'clock. So from 5 o'clock on, what I want you to do is I want you to come upstairs and clean the executive's restroom. We'll pay you overtime, but you're gonna come up and clean the executive restrooms. Now, that wasn't my classification. That's not what I was hired for. But that was an additional assignment duty as assigned, right? So what do? It's in the job description, all duties as assigned. So I cleaned those restrooms. Now, when I first went to that restroom, it was an executive restroom, but it was absolutely filthy. I had never seen a restroom like that in my life. And I had no supplies. I used my own money to go out and buy supplies. And within a week, I had that restroom spotless. Because I refused to fail. I refused to fail. And when that individual's boss eventually came and he saw me and he says, what are you doing up here cleaning these restrooms? And I said, well, this is what I was told to do for an additional assignment. I'm getting paid overtime for it. He said, that's not in your job description. I said, I know, but this has been assigned to me, so I'm going to do it. And he went in there and he said, that's the best I've ever looked at those restrooms. Now, I got a promotion out of the deal. But I'm going to tell you, there was 2 years prior to that I lived a nightmare trying to just do the job I was hired to do, but then also treat it differently. So yeah. So when you start talking about things like recruiting and looking for people that are going to diversify the workforce, go where the people are. You'll find that there will be qualified people in those environments.
Yeah, that's good.
You don't
that's
have to settle.
Let's go into some stats. These are some studies that have been done. African Americans are incarcerated at more than 5 times the rate of white people. The imprisonment rate for African American women are twice that of white women. Though African Americans and Hispanics, they only make up 32% of the U.S. population. So African Americans combined with Hispanics are only a third. All right. They comprise 56% of all incarcerated people. African Americans and Hispanics, they were incarcerated at the same rates if they were incarcerated at the same rates that white people are, prison and jail populations would decline by 40%. As we look at stats like this, and Alex, I want to come to you first. As a man that wore the blue, and you have seen as a police officer, what are you seeing, and can speak to these stats. How does it lay out in America whenever it comes to the illegal activity that we see that all people commit, and yet it's highlighted here how many black people and Hispanic people are in jail and in prison because of their behavior?
Sure. And I'm going to start this discussion off with, I saw something posted one time, and some of you may have seen this because there is a very, very famous show out there, and it features a rap artist, and it features someone who has been a homemaker, a model, who was very wealthy. And the post was, one of these individuals is a convicted felon. Can you guess which one? And even though people know who the convicted felon is, they automatically look at this guy who is the rap artist, who has never been convicted of a felony, and say, well, that is a convicted felon. Even though his behavior may not meet what we would call good behavior for our society, the fact of the matter is he still is not a convicted felon. But she is. They have a cooking show on, and people love that show, and they love his raw talent and her reserve talent that gets a little raw on the edge at time. My point is this: a lot of times, what happens is minorities, they are represented by public defenders. They're represented by legal counsel who are often very well overworked, very well underpaid, and don't understand all the nuances. And so what happens so many times is that individuals, they either have records for minor crimes that kind of frustrate the system, if you would, and by the time that they're ready, they are sentenced to incarceration for a lengthy period of time, they've probably been in and out of the system a little bit as a juvenile. And as a result, people look at that and say, wow, really, really, really bad, need to go away for a long time. My concern is not just the rate of incarceration, but what happens in incarceration. Because while you incarcerated, being in that environment, these people are not being rehabilitated oftentimes. It has only been in the last 10, 15 years, really, that there's been an emphasis to get them skills and get them educated. And Frederick Douglass, I remember when he made a statement 7 years after he was released or he escaped from slavery. Frederick Douglass made a statement, and he talked about how free he felt initially when he got to safety. But he said that feeling didn't last long, because then I was captivated by the feeling that someone was going to find out that I was a runaway, and someone was going to try to recapture me and take me back into slavery, and I had to be careful how I act. And so sometimes when these individuals, they get out of prison, they don't know how to really integrate again into society, and they're given $75 a bus ticket and sent to some community to go find a way to live. And when they get back to what should be society, they, things have changed around them. People don't receive them like they would. And so I'm thankful for places like our Grant County Rescue Mission and the work that Rick and his team does there, because they receive people and they treat them well. But they also say, listen, you need a skill. You need something to balance your life. You need hope. And I love the fact that they introduce them to Christ. So that they find ways to help these individuals really integrate back into society. Yes. The other thing is, again, you talk about some of those biases. Again, if you think about some of the crimes, I could spend a lot of time on this, because I can go back to a book that a guy by the name of Terry Williams wrote called The Cocaine Kids, that goes back and talks about the Rockefeller laws when in the early 1970s, there were no juvenile detention facilities. And when there were mandatory drug sentences, they went into Harlem and really got the young African-American and Latino kids in those barrios to be the mules to carry the drugs, because there were no places for juveniles, but there were mandatory drug sentences. And so then you had more and more people incarcerated for longer periods of time without any hope. When you talk about acculturation and lack, people do what they feel like they have to do to survive. And without education and without opportunity, people will resort to anything. And so what we have to understand is, yes, there is a higher rate of incarceration, but the emphasis should be on how do we get these people who are being incarcerated to better opportunities? How do we get them to advance themselves in education? How do we get them to advance themselves in skill sets that they can become successful and work in communities?
Yeah, that's a good word.
So we're so glad that you were with us today. You can subscribe on iTunes or Spotify or your preferred podcasting app. Be sure to rate us so other people can know about the podcast. Thank you.